Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Bruce Rogers Vaughn, Associate Professor of the Practice of Pastoral Theology and Counseling, about his recent book, Caring for Souls in a Neoliberal Age. Bruce, thanks for being willing to
be interviewed. Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
So what brought you to write this book?
Well, I really began the book there. My background is as a psychotherapist, a clinician, so I'm always interested in why people do what they do. So I'm not having to write books and do research for tenure. I'm a non-tenured practice faculty. So this is really out of my passion for questions that have been sitting with me for a number of years after 30 years of practice as a clinician. So the first thing that got me interested in this book is noticing changes in my patients, my psychotherapy patients, beginning from the late 80s, roughly, until now. And I just started noticing shifts enough to say that the people I sit with today in general are not the same as the people I sat with in the late 80s and the early 90s. Hmm. There's a great deal more what we would call addictive processes and behaviors going on, compulsive activities. There's a great deal more depression than there was, and there was a lot then. There's even more now. Panic attacks, mood disorders have all increased across the board. And although it's not a diagnosable label, there's a great deal more self-blame going on. So the degree of shame has increased. People are more likely to come in my office and say they are the problem, as opposed to come in my office and point to their boss or their unruly uncle or parent. I mean, they still talk about family. But at the end of the day, no matter what the problem is, even if it's a trauma that they knew they could not avoid, they blame themselves if they don't get better. So even in those cases, people feel like they've got to bootstrap it, basically. And if they fail in that effort, they feel responsible for their depression or addiction or whatever's going on. So I noticed a change in my patients. A second motive for me writing the book, given what's gone on in the culture since 1980, which is neoliberalization, a new phase of capitalism, we'll perhaps get to that later. I grew up in a working class family, and my father was a factory hand for over 40 years, member of a union. His father and grandfather before him were with the United Mine Workers. Out of my two dozen or so cousins, I said in the book I didn't have any that went to college, and my sister later corrected me. I have one younger cousin who finally went to college and finished. So what this means is my family back in Alabama are still all working class people. My sister makes a living doing manicures. Her husband drives a truck for UPS. I have another cousin I mentioned in the book who died from a work-related injury. Because he didn't have sufficient health care. So I'm concerned about what rising inequality in the country is doing, especially to working class people, but that would include the middle class, which is being eroded and looks a lot more like the working class. I mean, heck, even the professoriate looks more like the working class than it looked in the 70s and 80s. And I think we're in a lot of denial about that in the academy, but it's true nonetheless. Because universities were some of the first institutions in the United States to be neoliberalized, if you will, by policy and function. The third reason I was motivated to do this has to do with the title of the book, and that's Care of Souls. A general way to talk about Care of Souls is this has to do with attending to people in terms of how they make meaning or purpose in their lives, individually and collectively. That would be different, for example, than a method of mental health treatment that just focuses on expunging symptoms, you know, getting rid of depressive symptoms or panic attacks or whatever's getting in a person's way, you know, eliminating an addiction. Caring for souls goes beyond that to try to understand and ideally to help people understand themselves in terms of why they do what they do and what it means to them, where it comes from. The phrase caring for souls, of course, has a long history in Christian traditions, and some might consider it passé, but I'm obviously trying to reclaim this term. Like many other theological terms, I'll just go into that for a moment. Like many theological terms, we sometimes, oddly enough, as theological faculty, want to move away from or give up these terms. And we're either embarrassed by some of the associations to the term, the so-called baggage it carries. But by the way, any word that is deep and has texture, what my mentor Ed Farley used to call deep symbols, words like law, obligation, hope, love, God. These terms all have baggage, so it's impossible to have a term like that that doesn't have baggage you're embarrassed about. So the question is, are you going to reclaim the term? In other words, what was its original intent? What still makes sense? What, to use Farley's phrase, is retrievable about this term? So I care about the care of souls, and academically, one thing I try to do in this book is to retrieve the term soul. So for me, soul does not refer to, you know, an immaterial something that exists and then is planted into bodies when they're born. It doesn't refer to a supernatural essence of some kind that's different from or over against the body. I think one section in the book I refer to a very material soul, as I call it. So I understand soul in the book as literally the material fabric that connects us to ourselves, to one another as human beings, to life on the planet, to society at large, and to the earth and the cosmos. How's that for a grand idea? So it's a very expansive term in terms of what it includes. Instead of saying it's something that resides inside an individual, it is a texture in which, a fabric in which the individual participates that connects him to others. Now that's in itself an ontology, just the way things are. To talk about soul is to go one step beyond ontology and to say that we soul is when we exist in this fabric, in the posture of care, in the posture of love or compassion or reverence. So it is a way of existing in this fabric of connection. So to track back, those are the three reasons I wrote the book. I came out of concern for what was going on with my patients, and literally saying to myself, what the hell's going on here? Now that I have the long view as a practitioner, my connection to working class people to this day, and having grown up working class, and what is going on with them, which, by the way, as I make clear in a chapter on class, race, and gender issues, is not limited to what we've seen since the Trump election, the white working class. The working class is disproportionately women and people of color. So we've got this unfortunate dualism going on politically between, is it class or is it race? It's both. I don't think we can understand either one separate from themselves. But that's the reason I wrote the book.
Okay. Thank you. So You've already mentioned the significance of this shift and its connection to what you call the rise or development of neoliberalism. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what how you would describe the neoliberal age, and at this point, if you could talk a little bit about how we got here. I mean, how mm-hmm. what is its history, mm-hmm. and how you would talk about it economically and culturally, which are just something that you do at the beat, characterizing it as a patient or as a problem. As I don't earlier in the book, how would you characterize
neoliberalism?
Yeah.
Right. So this taps into the part of me that's a bit of a historian. Mm-hmm. I was almost a history major in college, and I've never lost interest in history. And one of my mentors here when I did my PhD was Liston Mills. And Liston used to say to us, you don't understand something unless you know its history. Mm. And so that's true of neoliberalism, of course. So neoliberalism is actually a phase or a type of capitalism that began to emerge, well, we'd have to walk it back to the 1930s, actually, when at that time, a rather vagabond group of economists were meeting in Europe, mostly led by Friedrich von Hayek, who was an Austrian philosopher, economist. He was a bit of both. And neoliberalism at that time, and they used that phrase, especially the German ordoliberals that were part of that group, to form the Mont-Pelerin Society. Hmm. And this was where the term was first coined. It was coined as an alternative to, on the one side, laissez-faire capitalism, because there was a recognition in this group that the government had to play a role for the economy to be, quote, free. To meet those demands for it to be free. On the other side, the straw man, so to speak, that they were fighting against were state-controlled economies. Mm. So they were against socialism, communism, those kinds of collectives in all their forms. So they were trying to thread the needle and form another way for capitalism to exist. What eventually emerged was what we now know of in terms of economic and political policy, what two authors call the DLP formula. Mm-hmm. So neoliberalism has to do with deregulation, liberalization, and privatization. The deregulation means, you know, taking controls off of corporations, giving them more latitude to make decisions about how they participate in the economy. We've heard lots about this in American politics since the 80s, beginning with roughly Reagan, although it kind of started under Carter. Liberalization refers not to one's theological position or political position, but is about the flow of capital around the world. So liberalization means taking down tariffs and those kinds of barriers that prevent the sale and transfer of either products, or more importantly for the neoliberal age, simply capital, cash, currencies even, to be traded and travel around the world, which all is now aided by the internet. Mm. So it really is liberalized flow now. It literally flows over the internet. There's more debt traded today than there are goods and services traded. So one historian, Stephen Fraser, says we should contrast today's capitalism with that of the early 20th century. That was the industrial age. So that was industrial capitalism. This is the age in which Marx wrote. Hmm. So his conceptualities fit industrial capitalism. What we have today, Fraser says, is finance capitalism. Well, finance capitalism makes money by investing money, mainly by buying up and trading debt, which is a fascinating shift in capitalism. But back to the DLP formula. Mm-hmm. The P stands for privatization, which means we're going to have as little as possible owned and run by governments, by states. We're going to turn over properties, lands, services to the, quote, private sector, which is a euphemism for corporations. The idea being that supposedly there's a lot of waste in government. Private corporations run more efficiently and effectively, so we'll have things running better if corporations do it. We could get off now on a jag in politics. The fact that private corporations have to make profit means not all the money goes to that service, so there's a problem here that we're beginning to see. But the DLP formula kind of is a shorthand for how neoliberalism looks in action. But backing up historically, mm-hmm. we should also think of neoliberalism not as a noun, but as a verb. Most scholars who study this now say we should talk about neoliberalization as a reflexive process because it's constantly morphing and changing to fit its environments, both temporally and locally. And so the temporal process is, I think Peck talks about this. He says the first phase as neoliberalization kicks in is what he calls the rollout phase. So the rollout phase is the DLP. This is when things are made to conform to those policies. And one thing that happens during the rollout phase is it begins to dismantle collectives that would resist those programs, such as unions. Union membership has declined precipitously since the 1980s. So has religious institutions, by the way. I can't think of any kind of collective that has not declined. So, which gets into some other questions we could talk about, but that happens in the rollout phase. The next phase is called the rollback phase. This is when we begin to have consequences and flack, like from the austerity politics of the rollout phase, and there begins to be problems. There begins to be disjunctures in what neoliberalization claims to do. So the rollout phase is when society and the economy is re-regulated instead of unregulated, and it's re-regulated in conformity to the interests of capital, mainly large corporations and staggeringly wealthy individuals. And this is where things like surveillance, policing, and militarization come into play. It's the law and order politics that we now see. And that is to try to keep the peace because everybody's getting upset
about
their wages going down. Exactly. Yeah, okay. And the conflicts that are created by this enormously fascinating process we call neoliberalization, which is now global. So it's not just the U.S. and Britain, which is kind of where it started. It has been globalized to the world, mainly through the actions of international economic bodies like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and structures like that, as well as the now infamous trade agreements, you know, NAFTA, TAFTA, TPP, all of these, and basically through the IMF and the World Bank, lending, for example, to developing countries was made conditional on them accepting the policies that were at that time called the Washington Consensus. So some of this has not been pretty. It's not just been a peacefully evolving process. It has looked like that for the most part in North America and Britain. But in other parts of the world, it looks like old-fashioned colonialism, and even with military force behind it. If not military force, economic force and coercion. So we should talk about neoliberalization in all those kinds of ways. What I emphasize in the book is that neoliberalization has a cultural component. So it's not just political and economic. It also gets to define the realm of values, what matters in human life, in human society. And some key terms there are entrepreneurship, individual responsibility, competition. So if I could boil down neoliberalization in the cultural realm, I would point to those terms. this helps explains what's happened to my patients over the years.
Yeah, so here we get from the, I mean, hearing this, the audience might think, so what does this have to do with caring for souls here?
Exactly. So taking those three terms and saying just a little bit about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think first, competition is important. Wendy Brown wrote a book called Undoing the Demas. She's a Foucault scholar. And points out how that old-fashioned capitalism of our grandparents worked on a logic of exchange. A quote, as would have been the language of that day, a gentleman's agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I give you something, you give me something in return. It's a handshake or a contract or whatever. But the idea is that both parties have benefited from the exchange. That's capitalism of the old days, so to speak. Under neoliberalization, inequality is assumed because it's built into the notion of competition. The idea here is what some have called Darwinian.
Mm-hmm.
So if you free up the market, it's going to run by competition, and the people, there will be a few winners and multitudes of losers under this system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no longer equal exchange. It's exchange under the pressure of inequality, that people are not equal at the bargaining table. So that's simply assumed these days. And it's even said to be virtuous, the way it ought to be, because any other way would not be fair, according to this argument. The people who are losers should be losers. Why? Because they're less ambitious, they're less talented, they're less gifted. Too bad for them. It's for the sake of progress. That's competition. These all go together.
Mm-hmm.
So entrepreneurship goes with this. An entrepreneur is someone who's responsible for their own advancement. They're self-marketing. They build their own brand. In common language, it's what we call the Facebook age. So now we're all little capitals. As Wendy Brown points out, we all are little corporations unto ourselves, even though it's not always monetized. You know, we're promoting ourselves through social media, networking, whatever contact we can. We all act like this. We're all acting like little, including me. We're all acting like little companies. Now, which one I'll leave out? Entrepreneurship, competition, privatization, individualism, individual responsibility, to be exact. So this is the water we now swim in. We don't know there's any other way to live than to think of individuals as being solely responsible for themselves and no one else. So gone are ideas of obligation to others, that we should be looking after the care of others. No, we should leave them up to their own care. That's the way things are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does this mean in terms of my book and Caring for Souls? This means if somebody's suffering, if they're depressed, if they're addicted, if they're poor, it's their own damn fault. All right? They got there because of decisions they made. Maybe if they're unlucky, they had some bad genes or a trauma thrown in there somewhere. But even in those cases, it's believed that they are the ones responsible to get the resources they need to get better. It's all on them. And if they don't do it, it's back to their fault again. So the result of this is, as William Davies says, in neoliberalization, we have multiple inequalities. We not only have economic inequality, which is now obvious, we not only have political inequality, because resources to endless cash reserves means you can buy off any government you want to in terms of getting policies passed. We have psychological inequality, okay? Because there's far more depression in terms of suffering, addiction, and so forth among the working class and even the middle class than in what Occupy would have called the 1%. Doesn't mean the 1% are not suffering. I would argue under neoliberalization, we're all suffering more than we were in 1980. But it's especially problematic for those who are not in the 1%, mm-hmm. for the 99%. Mm-hmm. We might point to recent news about the opiate addiction mm-hmm. among working class mm-hmm. folks mm-hmm. of all races, right. by the way. It's showing up more among white working class currently, but drug issues, substance abuse addictions is very common in the working class in particular.
You're pushing in the direction of what I wanted to ask you about next, which has to do with the neoliberal infiltration of the living human web, as you call it, mm-hmm. in one of your chapters. And you talk about three levels of effects at the social, the interpersonal, and the psychological. And I think you've touched on this. I wonder if you had any more that you wanted to say about three levels and how.
I could talk all day. So first of all, a shout out to my colleague here on the faculty at Vanderbilt, Bonnie Miller McLemore, who coined the phrase "the living human web" mm-hmm. a few years ago. So I'm capturing that phrase that she has provided to talk about how neoliberalization occurs in culture. Mm-hmm. So this chapter you're pointing to is about culture. In other words, not political or economic effects, right. but the cultural mm-hmm. effects. And I'm using this tripartite division pedagogically. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can rigidly separate social institutions from interpersonal relationships from the individual psyche. Mm-hmm. To me, they all meld into what Bonnie calls the living human web. They're all interconnected and therefore affect each other. At the same time, we can discern kinds of systems that function unto themselves, open-ended systems, even though they're entangled. Mm-hmm. So in this chapter, I talk about how neoliberalization affects all three of these dimensions of the web. The first being social. And by social, I mean basically human collectives, human institutions. So what neoliberalization does is it goes into the web of the human masses, is it begins to dismantle institutions that would obstruct its agenda, while importantly magnifying the power of institutions that it has control of or supporting it, which generally comes down to governments and corporations. Mm-hmm. So the power of states, we're by no means at the end of nation states. Nation states have now been co-opted by neoliberal agendas as tools or as partners in this enterprise, while corporations also have grown stronger. All other human collectives that I can think of are being eroded mm-hmm. as we speak. Unions, in particular, labor. Obviously, this would obstruct a so-called free market as it is envisioned by neoliberalization. But also other human institutions that hold values that would push back against a system like neoliberalism, which is given solely to increasing profits, economic profits. You know, as Christians, for example, we think Jesus might have had something to say about that, right? So forms of Christianity and congregations and denominations and religious movements in Christianity, for example, that would push back and say, this disagrees with our values. These are being eroded. This is empirically verified. I'm not speculating on this. General social surveys, which come out of the University of Chicago and University of California, the University of California system, have been doing social surveys since 1972, I believe, that are used as kind of the gold standard for sociological, anthropological studies in the U.S. And they have shown that religion as in organized religion, mm-hmm. institutions that mm-hmm. I'm talking about, since neoliberalization began in the 70s and 80s until today, all those religions are declining in the United States. Mm-hmm. The number of nuns, mm-hmm. people have not committed, who don't participate in religious, not only Christians, but all faith groups in the U.S., has held steady since the 1930s. This is back before the General Social Survey. We were still keeping tabs on that. Held steady between 5 to 8%, roughly, were, quote, not affiliated. Mm-hmm. Beginning in the mid-80s, roughly, that figure steadily increased until now it's just above 20%. The only groups within Christianity that are not declining in the United States right now are like the Roman Catholic Church, and it's holding steady, the main reason being immigration. Some groups are growing, like Muslim congregations mm-hmm. are growing, but again, because of immigration. So if you take immigration out of the equation, they're all declining. Mm. This used to be the so-called decline of the mainline mm-hmm. that Wade Clark and Roof were exploring. Mm-hmm. I'm old enough to remember that. The decline of the mainline was the enigma. But now, as Butler Bass showed in her latest book, which I'm blanking on the title of, she has shown that even conservative evangelical groups and Pentecostal mm-hmm. groups are declining now in terms of attendance and participation. So that's an example mm-hmm. of erosion, not only of so-called secular groups like unions, but religious groups. I think this has to do with neoliberalization and not secularization, as we're often led to believe. Maybe more on that
later. Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit later.
But staying with the living human web for the moment. In the interpersonal area, neoliberalization, because it's built on competition, entrepreneurship, and individual responsibility, those values erode interpersonal commitments. This is kind of a no-brainer when you think about it. So now it makes sense to most of us to not stay in a committed relationship if it doesn't, quote, work for me anymore. If it's not promoting my brand, if it's not doing anything for me to advance my own capital in the world, whether that capital is monetary or just value, we're kind of crazy to not unfriend that person, right? One of the most useful ways to look at this in terms of empirical evidence is to look at marriage. Now, we don't have statistics yet to follow longitudinally same-sex marriage, but we have quite a lot of data on heterosexual marriages. And the marriage rate, as sociologists, divorce rate is what tends to get the headlines. Well, the divorce rate has not changed much. It's waxed and waned over the decades, throughout the 20th century and into the 21st. What has changed is the marriage rate. And I won't go into how sociologists define that. It's a peculiar algorithm mm-hmm. they use. But the marriage rate has to do with the number of people who marry mm-hmm. to begin with. It began to decline, surprise, surprise, in the 1980s and has declined precipitously ever since. We have fewer people getting married in the United States today than ever since this has been recorded. In terms of the marriage rate. It's now like at 5.6. 5.6 means 5.6 marriages out of, and here's the algorithm, females between 14 and 70-something that are single who marry in a given year out of 1,000 of such women. We're now down to 5.6. It usually was hovering around 12 to 16.
Wow.
12 to 16. Now it's 5.6. Two female lawyers, Carbone and Kahn, have written a wonderful book called Marriage Markets, where they document this. And note that, here we are again, another inequality, that this has occurred along lines of class. Hmm. So if you're in the wealthier class, say even the top 5%, the marriage rate is actually increasing. Hmm. So all 100% of the decline in the marriage rate since 1980 has been among the middle and working class, especially among the working class. So Jennifer Silva interviewed about 150 working class millennials. So these are young people in the working class to see, this is one of the issues she was looking at. Mm-hmm. So she would interview women in the working class, white, African-American, and other minorities. This was true across the board, transracially. The kinds of answers she would get from these women were, no, I'm not going to marry. That's just taking on another mouth to feed. I can barely feed my kids if they have kids. Mm-hmm. Why would I want to do that? Well, neoliberalization has put a phenomenal number of men out of work since the 1980s. So that's another way to talk about neoliberalism versus older capitalism. Saskia Sassen, who's a sociologist at Harvard, has written a book called Expulsions. She said, old capitalism, conventional capitalism, was a system of inclusion. It needed workers in order to put out products to sell. So it included, not necessarily fairly, but it included as many people as possible. Even back in the days of slavery, slavery was a form of inclusion. It was unjust, but slaves were an important part of the system of labor that made capitalism work. We forget about that, how important slavery was to capitalism. So it was a system of inclusion. What we have now, she says, is a capitalism that is a system of expulsion. It gets rid of as many workers as possible. Why? It increases the profit rate. Hmm. So Marx is still right, even though you have to refinagle his theory for finance capitalism. So we're getting rid of as many people as possible. Well, this has resulted in men, who can no longer earn a living enough to provide for families. So this is eroding the marriage rate among the working class in particular, and even the middle class. So again, back to the living human web, interpersonal relationships are becoming fragmented. And I'm pointing to marriage as an exhibit in that book. I think all kinds of human relationships are fragmenting. Networking with people for business purposes and to promote your brand is not the same as committed relationships. So that's a problem. And it has to do with the care of souls. Even the care of collectives has to do with the care of souls, because after all, again, soul is a fabric that connects us all materially with one another and makes us dependent on one another. Now, the last part is the individual, the psyche, as we say. This has been a period in which the individual psyche has become fragmented. And this gets back to changes I've seen in my patients, my psychotherapy patients. Fragmentation, people who have little sense of who they are, a durable sense of any kind of identity, except identities provided by the market, by the way. There are commodity identities that we tend to buy into based on consumerism.
Such as?
Well, I think a lot of this has gone along with activity oriented. So if I'm a marathon runner, that's what I am. And so we have a whole commodity fetish built around appliances and gear.
What does it mean to be in
that?
Right.
And, you know, activities, clubs that we can join. These are not necessarily committed interpersonal relationships. These are relationships with things and with people who do similar activities. Yeah. They might develop into interpersonal relationships, but that isn't what it's structured for. We also should say that we have identities. How did you phrase the question?
Well, In terms of the three levels, or
the individual people, the way they fragment, or the way they hang together.
Right.
Now.
Right.
We also do it by cultural identities. Uh-huh. The ones that are forever named under the value of diversity and multiculturalism usually revolve around race, gender, sexual orientation, mm-hmm. and so forth. These are other ways that are now neoliberal approved. All right. Not that we shouldn't do that. I'm just saying neoliberalism has taken advantage of these cultural identities for purposes of profit. Mm. It's commodified them, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. But absent these kind of, I think you were asking me about neoliberal provided identities. That's where I got started.
Okay, sorry.
so we have those.
Right.
But aside from those, people are really struggling to know who they are, because if you don't know where you belong, what family, what collective, what religious tradition or body, what neighborhood, what union, what group of people you're committed to, then you don't know who you are. Mm. This is how we exist as individuals. Neoliberalism tries to take individuality and split it off from those kinds of collectives. So you can be an individual, you can be autonomous without any of those things. You can be a self unto yourself, basically. And this has just become today what we think of as gospel. That's the way it is. Well, it's not. It's a heresy. You can't be a cohesive, durable individual without these social supports that we've always had. That's not to mean they're all righteous. Mm-hmm. You know, these institutions often have done very bad things. But just like the word soul, that doesn't mean you throw out institutions. It means you make them more just. Mm-hmm. So,
and, I mean, central to your discussion of, well, I suppose all layers of this, of the effects that neoliberalization has, is the concept of the suffering that it's causing. And you suggest there are several different kinds of suffering, and that neoliberalization is actually created a form of suffering that we really haven't seen in the past. So what is that?
So this is one of my ambitious claims in the book, right? And I can kind of jump off from where I was talking to talk about that. Mm-hmm. So staying for a moment with the level of the individual.
Yeah.
It's been very popular in circles where we value postmodern critical theories, for mm-hmm. example. To talk about the multiple discontinuous fluid self. Mm. This is thought to be a good thing. What we haven't realized is it isn't experienced by people as a good thing. If multiple discontinuous and fluid means fragmented, it's a disaster. And it fuels a worldwide epidemic now, a pandemic of depression and addiction. These are the diseases of the neoliberal era. And they are rooted in this fragmentation we're talking about, which brings us back to suffering. Mm-hmm. How's the suffering today different? I think we've always appreciated, those of us who do, who are attuned to cultural difference and even historical differences, time and place, know that suffering under one time and place doesn't look the same as another time and place. So far, so good. But let me get what I'm talking about first, second, and third order. Because mm-hmm. this is kind of an ontology of suffering I'm talking about. First order suffering, as I am referring to in the book, is the kinds of human suffering that are just built into being a human being. To the fact that we don't choose whether we're born, we don't choose whether we'll die, we don't choose whether we're subject to certain limitations. Disease, disability, death, separation, grief, these things are unavoidable. Hmm. They'll happen to us regardless. It doesn't matter where you're in the 1%, the 99%, or what culture you live in. It will take different forms, ritually and in terms of expression, by various cultures. But they're universals.
Mm-hmm.
That's first order suffering. And pastoral care, the care of souls, has always been attentive to grief, death, and so forth. Second order suffering is suffering that exists by virtue of what we would call injustice. These are the kinds of suffering human beings perpetrate upon one another. It appears in the whole spectrum of the living human web. And, you know, at the top or social level, it includes war between nations and peoples. It can include racism and sexism and identity-based oppressions based on ascriptions of gender, sexuality, and race. It can occur in interpersonal relationships due to personal betrayals, being stabbed in the back, as we use the idiomatic expression. These are second orders of suffering, suffering that technically are not necessary, are technically eliminatable if we wanted to create a just world. Again, care of souls has always been attentive to these kinds of suffering when they occur. We try to create a more just world. That's a way that we try to care for souls. Third order suffering, here comes the problem. I'm not saying that first and second order suffering have been superseded by third order suffering. They don't go away.
Mm-hmm.
This new form of suffering is just rising up alongside and within them and infuses them. So I'm saying it's actually beginning to transform first and second order suffering. So I got the idea basically reading the work of Danny Robert Dufour, the French philosopher, who wrote a book a few years ago called The Art of Shrinking Heads. I think he wrote it in, I'm thinking, the 90s.
Hmm.
It was translated into English early in the 2000s. But he looked in the book at how late capitalism is changing human beings. And he says that because, again, it changes culture, neoliberalism has produced, he says, a mutation of the human species. And he uses these very unwieldy terms, as the French are prone to do, neologisms. He called it deinstitutionalization, desymbolization, and desubjectivation. So I just call them the three Ds. So deinstitutionalization is something I've already referred to. It's the dismantling of collectives. This started to be written about early on. Pierre Badiou wrote about it as well in the 70s and 80s, that late capitalism was determined to fragment human society, to tear apart institutions and collectives, to make us all, you know, isolated individuals, basically. By the way, consumption and production works better if people are all isolated individuals. You have no power to refuse or push back against an advertisement or marketing if you're all alone. You can only do that as a group. So deinstitutionalization is part of it. These go together. They interpenetrate. They're entangled. So the desymbolization has to do with the erosion of having a language, a common language, if you will, that expresses values, ways that we understand we're going to live together. These can be religious or non-religious. It can be the symbol systems of unions, and the way unions talk to each other.
Again, the collective symbol systems.
Exactly. So symbolization has to do with what human beings do together. In theology, we're back to what Ed Farley wrote about when he talked about deep symbols. And in his book by that title, which I think was the late 90s, even Ed Farley said that what we're seeing today is not one symbol system replacing another, which is what has happened throughout history when there's a revolution like the Enlightenment. We have one symbol system replacing another symbol system. What he said we're having happen today is the disappearance of symbols altogether. We have words, but words now become signifiers, like they are in marketing, as opposed to a symbol, to use Paul Tillich's phrase, is a sign that points beyond itself, right? So it has depth, has texture. It carries baggage, as I talked about earlier. Words like soul and hope and love. Well, these kinds of language systems are being broken apart and fragmented, are being rendered meaningless, basically. So as Farley used to say, we now put scare quotes out beside words like reality,
right,
or not to mention God, or love. We put scare quotes beside everything. And the quotes, you can't hear it on the audio cast, I'm using my fingers to put air quotes in there. They're used in writing to signify that we're not quite to take this term very seriously. We all know we have now superseded these old ancient terms, and they don't mean anything anymore.
Soul, by the way, does not have scare quotes in this book.
No, I do not put scare quotes around soul in this book. I put them around some other things,
right,
like the free market, which is not free for so many reasons. So that's desymbolization, the getting rid of a common language, a way of talking. Or as Nick Coldry, a British author, says, this is a decline in voice, having voice. The last one, desubjectivation, I've also already talked about, and that's the fragmentation of the self or the individual. So these three things hang together, and they produce a kind of suffering, I would argue, we haven't seen before. Now, let me put a qualifier on that. Dufour is a little overambitious. He says this is a mutation that has never before existed. That's not quite true, because as Bruce Alexander points out in his book, The Globalization of Addiction, pandemics of addiction have broken out. He uses historical cases to show, like with Native Americans, when people came from Europe, began to force Native Americans off their land, we had then what I would call third order suffering. In other words, the institutions began to fall apart of the Native American tribes. The ritualization begins to be attacked. So the symbol system begins to be eroded, and the individuals, Native Americans, begin to fall ill to addictions, to actual physical disease, for that matter. So I'm going to qualify what I'm saying to say this kind of suffering has existed before, but it's existed as a transitional state. It's existed in a crisis state when people are between two different things, two different cultures, and a new normal has not been achieved. What we have today is very different. What we have today, as Bruce Alexander and Dufour both talked about, is we have deinstitutionalization, desymbolization, desubjectivation occurring under normal times, not as a crisis. So the better neoliberalism runs, the sicker we get. It produces this thing as a byproduct of doing well. So Bruce Alexander says, that the better today's capitalism runs, the more social dislocation occurs as a normal state of being. So, for example, one person I cite in the book, Eric Kasdan, has a book called The Already Dead. In that book, he cites a concept he calls the new chronic. The new chronic is another way of talking about third-order suffering. And the analogy he uses is, yeah, we're all doing okay, like someone who's HIV-infected under a retroviral virus treatment, or a diabetic on insulin. We're held in this steady state, but we're not cured. Right? It doesn't go away. So the best we can do with third order suffering in this neoliberal age is a kind of maintenance, administration of suffering, where we hold people in this state of suspended animation suffering that doesn't go away. So rolling back, it's very different to sit with someone as a caregiver, religious or otherwise, a concerned friend even, whose parent just died, in cultures where third order suffering was unheard of, where there was a symbol system for making sense out of it. Never mind if it was good sense or bad sense, it made sense somehow that this death has occurred and how one is supposed to relate to the deceased or to go on living if you have an intact symbol system. Likewise, it's a different thing to go through that if you have a collective around you that is supporting you, partly by means of this symbol system, which also means you have a more or less cohesive, durable sense of self with which to face this loss. But what about now? So that's first order suffering. Third order suffering has modified first order suffering to look like third order suffering. So now if a parent dies, you may not have a collective around you. There may only be people on Facebook who are, you know, tagging with likes or, you know, emojis that they're sorry about your loss. That's not a neighborhood or a community. Unless they, of course, already know you off of Facebook. You no longer have, perhaps, a belief system that somehow makes sense of mortality, or at least not makes sense of it in explaining it away, but how one lives in such a world with such a loss. And, subjectively, you may not even have a durable enough sense of self to face that kind of loss without resorting to anesthetizing yourself. This is where addictions come in, or persisting in a depression that never goes away. I've seen this again and again and again in my clinical practice. I could cite many examples of a physician, for example, whose wife died a number of years ago, who was his way of staying in touch with the world, because he was mentally ill. And when she died, he was no longer able to function, even as a physician. Because why? Not only did his wife, was his wife not there, but there was no other community around him to support him. So these are the kinds of things that I'm talking about when I talk about third order suffering. And I'm arguing that it's changing the way social, you know, second order suffering is done, like racism and sexism, for example, or class struggle. All of these are being altered by third order suffering because we don't have any more dependable symbolics, dependable collectives. The civil rights movement in the 60s was a collective movement. It was not isolated African Americans, you know, posting things on Facebook about how they'd been treated at work that day. It was people in the streets, right? It was a material, political, collective movement. I'm not so sure we could have that movement today. Or if we had it today, it would have to be because we were rigorously working against the nature of third order suffering by reestablishing collectives again, making them workable collectives, religious or not, reinstilling hope, and making a place for the soul, which are the three things I talk about in the last chapter of the book. Without these three things, I don't see any way to move forward in the current age in terms of addressing suffering. We're just simply going to have people coming together spontaneously, because you can't build an artificial community. Stefan Mestrovic famously said in his book, The Post-Emotional Society, that you can no more build a community than you can build a forest. we're talking about something that has to be organic. It has to spring up out of certain conditions. So we need new collectives, maybe collectives we've never seen before. We don't know yet what they will look like. But this means giving up some of what we had in the 1960s, our hard-earned academic libertarianism. To commit yourself to collective means giving up some of your own individual autonomy. That's the only way a collective can sustain itself. You know, we make sacrifices to see that it goes forward. And these need to be collectives that sustain soul. Obviously, there are human collectives that don't. I've already talked about governments and corporations are also collectives. The Nazi Party was a collective, right? The KKK was a collective. So I'm not sentimentalizing collectives as if they're all, you know, this romantic ideal. It has to be a collective that maintains and sustains soul, which means justice, love, reverence, making a room for the other when that even that is uncomfortable for me. That's the kind of collective we need, and that's the kind of collective that maintains soul. And finally, these have to be collectives that maintain hope. I think I made a difference in that last section between, I think it was Jacoby who talked about blueprint utopianism versus iconoclastic utopianism. So here we are, we're having trouble again. So collectives are getting a bad name. We don't want to give up our individual freedoms. Well, utopianism has a bad name now, you know, because we think since, you know, communism has died and all the old socialist utopias are dead, we've passed those stage and now we're all into just practical reality, which is not true, by the way, because neoliberalism is itself a utopian movement that hides its utopianism by pretending to be practical and realist. Well, it's not. It believes that the free market will fix everything that's fixable. That's utopianism. So again, we have utopias that are destructive and utopias that are constructive. So iconoclastic utopianism is what we need. Not a utopianism that has planned everything in advance.
Five-year plans.
It's not a five-year plan. We don't know what it's going to look like. What we do know is the principles we're committed to. And we have a vision of what that might look like. You know, Martin Luther King called it the beloved community. Jesus called it the kingdom of God. So the nomenclature will vary by culture and what makes sense to a people. I still happen to like the beloved community. So we don't know how to plan it, build it, just like you don't know how to build a forest. You can't build an artificial community. But we need hope to inspire us to... All these three things work together. They are, to use the language of the book, entangled. So I shamelessly borrowed the word of William Connolly in the book, The Fragility of All Things. Fragility of Things, I believe, is the name of the book. He's one of a new cutting-edge group of thinkers that are called the New Materialists, which I like, this way of thinking. So the entanglement of all things means just that. It's literally, physically entangled. But that's true in the cultural realm, not just in the so-called material physical realm. So, collectives that maintain soul, that live in the mode of hope, these three things are entangled. If you take any one of them out, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, you've already, I wanted to ask you whether you see any embodiments of this. You've already seemed a bit pessimistic about that. So.
I think there was maybe even one place in the book where I admitted confessionally that as I was studying these things, I was tempted to despair.
Yes.
Right. But as Gabriel Marcel famously said, hope does not exist where the temptation to despair does not exist. Mm. You don't need hope if there's no despair. There's a very big difference between hope and optimism. Optimism tends to think that progress is inevitable, which is kind of how neoliberalism lives. Mm-hmm. Neoliberalism lives in the mode of optimism. You know, if we give the market free range, things are just going to turn out for the best. Mm-hmm. It's a blueprint utopianism, essentially. But back to your question, do these things exist in the real world, or is just this pie in the sky dreaming? I'm much more hopeful, actually, even than I was when I finished writing the book.
Okay.
And I'll point to something specific, a book that leads us to some other things that are specific. There's a book that came out after my book came out, or along about the same time, edited by Sabine Dreyer and Peter Smith. The book is entitled Religious Activism in the Global Economy. Hmm. And they make the claim that neoliberalization could not continue to overcome its fractures, its come-aparts, like the 2008 housing bubble, for example, mm-hmm. if religion weren't helping it out. I think that's true. I think, in the book, they explore religious movements that either promote neoliberalism, accommodate or try to reform neoliberalism, or third, are resisting neoliberalism. Hmm. Which relates to everything I've been talking about in the book. So it's correct that we need to make these discernments, especially as theologians and students of religion. So one of the obvious forms of global religiosity today that promotes neoliberalism is the prosperity gospel, mm-hmm. which exists in large components, I think not all, but large sectors of Pentecostalism, which are, by the way, very prominent in the global South and South America and the African continent today, as well as in North America and Europe. So it's a global movement. And the prosperity gospel basically justifies the neoliberal agenda. It justifies its class structure. It justifies its notion of competition. It even justifies its individualism. Hmm. In Christianity, which is the prosperity gospel, is a Christian movement. It says, for example, that one's relationship to Jesus is purely a personal one. It's an individual decision. It has nothing to do with the collective, right? And it teaches that if you live right, which means what? Paying your taxes, paying your debts, being a good debtor, being a good consumer, and working hard, Protestant work ethic, you will be rewarded how? You will be rewarded economically. Mm. So that's religion promoting. I'm getting to your question.
no doubt.
There are movements that are that see the problems, the social problems being created by neoliberalization. And these religious movements, in effect, are trying to tinker. Mm. It's like a religious New Deal, mm-hmm. where you don't do away with capitalism, you just make it kinder, gentler, mm. right? A kinder, gentler capitalism, or a kinder, gentler neoliberalism in this case. And there's things like, I think I may have made a note. Well, I didn't. But we have phrases like, socially sustainable investment. Mm. So forth. Mm-hmm. By and large, accommodation religion goes on even among mainstream Christianity, even among liberal progressive Christianity, where we think of improving people as giving them a hand up into the profits of capitalism, into the benefits of capitalism. And this goes on even in churches that have communitarian forms of ethics. That's not yet resistance. Hmm. So here's to your question. Mm-hmm. We have religious movements, according to Dreher and Smith, going on in the world today that are actually providing alternatives to contemporary capitalism, that even to the point of dismantling its class structure. And they point to three in particular. There's the religious environmental movement in the United States, which is going on among Christians, but also includes a number of Muslims, Hindus, Jews. It's trans-religious in terms of its membership, though it's primarily Christians, who are talking about disinvestment, who are talking about ceasing an expansion of consumption, questioning infinite growth, that is insane. And unlike so-called secular components of the environmental movement, the religious environmental movement is saying it's not just that it's not practical to continue this kind of capitalist expansion, like Naomi Klein talks about in her book. It is morally wrong. So they talk about the earth does not belong to human beings. It belongs to God. So they're making arguments based upon religious values. Well, if you follow this thinking to its bitter end, this would be the end of capitalism. You can't do away with infinite growth, for example. It's just choosing one part of it and preserve capitalism. It just couldn't happen. Another movement they're talking about, it's a worldwide religious movement, they call it the Global Justice Movement, or the GJM. Which today is being carried out by, in practical terms, by the World Social Forum. The WSF has been having annual meetings, or biannual, I forget which, for over a decade now. The World Social Forum's very motto, which they put on the platform every time they meet, another world is possible. They're actually trying to envision a new way to be human societies. Well, it so happens that even though it's not labeled a religious movement, most of the people supporting the World Social Forum say they're doing so for religious reasons, and especially those from the Global South. The World Council of Churches is a supporting organization to the WSF. So is the Lutheran World Federation. These together combined represent millions of Christians around the world. So, yes, there's actually things going on. I think, though, the most interesting one is the third one they mention. And that's the one going on in South America that goes by a number of names. Many people call it the Indianista movement. It's actually a movement now known as decolonialization, as opposed to post-colonialization. Decolonialization is a movement that's actually boots on the ground. Whereas they say post-colonialism kind of happens in the academy. People write in this abstract way of, i.e. post-colonial, that values, you know, indigenous literatures, indigenous cultures, and can the subaltern speak, and so forth. Decolonial folk are mainly working class people who are trying to change things on the ground and reverse colonization politically and economically. So in Bolivia, for example, the Indianista movement has taken a form called Indianismo. Well, Indianismo is an indigenous religiosity that talks about Pachamama, Mother Earth. And Mother Earth is believed to be cosmic in the sense that we all have a place in this cosmic system, in Mother Earth. It values diversity within equality. So without any of the diverse peoples of the earth, Pachamama would be incomplete and would be injured. So they value all indigenous people, people of all races, cultures, clans, all nations. Pachamama would be depleted without any one of them. they all must be included. Hmm. So it's inclusive in that decolonization sense. While preserving difference. Mm-hmm. Because if they ceased to be who they were, Pachamama would be depleted. Mm. Because it's systemic. Mm-hmm. They use the phrase buon vivere, living well, mm. to talk about sustainable living. Having more than you need is injuring other people, is injuring the planet. So in Bolivia, the Indianista movement, or Indianismo, the religiosity that promotes it, has achieved political success. So under the new Bolivian constitution, Pachamama has legal rights.
Wow.
You can sue a company on behalf of Pachamama.
Interesting.
In Bolivia. You can never do that in the United States.
Right.
Evo Morales, an indigenous leader of, in fact, the decolonial movement in Bolivia, was elected as the president. Mm-hmm. And because the world is not perfect, Evo Morales did some things that the Indianista movement didn't like, mm-hmm. even though he was one of them. And sure enough, they protested, pushed back, and he, you know, retrenched from some things he was trying to do. And another thing I like about Indianismo is it's reflexive. It knows that Indianismo, Pachamama, will not be achieved perfectly by human societies. So it remains self-critical as it tries to accomplish or move toward. It's in effect an iconoclastic utopian movement. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to say I've come across
after finishing
the book that I'm going, you know, it's not hopeless, but it's also by no means inevitable that things are going to turn out well. Mm. So without people really working hard, without it is no longer enough, even though we must do it. We must fight hate speech. We must fight discourse that is corrosive and erosive of human community. But fighting hateful discourse is nowhere near enough. We're not going to get the political change we need in this country or in the world without collective movements of people really coming together to fight injustice.
And what you've suggested is it's not even enough to do the work that you do, listening to individuals talk about their lives.
We cannot write our way into a new earth.
Right.
Academic work is not social justice work.
Right.
It may support social justice work, but it is not in itself the activism that is required. I'm well aware of that, but I'm also aware that some of the ways we thought about social justice in the academy actually hasn't brought about widespread change. Mm. So one of the problems I've talked about in the book is that, and I should mention before we close, is in the cultural arena, neoliberalization did some very clever things. And I don't mean to say that a bunch of people got in the back room and planned this. This was an organic movement that has emerged over time. But neoliberalization capitalized, no pun intended, on the freedom movements that emerged in the 1960s. These were global movements, as we know, in the 1960s. We now think back in the United States, this was the era of free love, the peace movement, and so forth. Well, this was an uneasy alliance, as David Harvey points out in his book, Brief History of Neoliberalism. The 60s freedom movements were an uneasy alliance, or uneasy sets of alliances, between all kinds of social justice movements. Movements to eliminate racism. Movements to eliminate gender inequality. Movements for freedom of sexual expression without being oppressed. Also included were economic justice movements at that time. So through the 60s and the 70s, workers' movements and movements for economic justice existed alongside of these other movements for social justice. What Harvey and a number of others have said is the process of neoliberalization drove a wedge through the social justice movement and created a split, a gap. On the one hand, and Lisa Dugan calls this the economics culture split. Nancy Fraser calls it the post-socialist condition. At any rate, it was a split that put cultural drives for social justice based on cultural identities on one side of the split, such as sexism, racism, sexuality, etc. And on the other side existed by itself economic justice, which was language about class, class conflict, and so forth. Once this split had occurred, the economics part fell off the face of the earth. So what we have now under neoliberalization is the valuing, believe it or not, this is now considered progressive, but it's thoroughly neoliberal. We have the value of diversity and multiculturalism, or what I call neoliberal identity politics. Now, I'm not saying that all identity politics is neoliberal. There are surviving remnants that aren't. But what neoliberal identity politics is an attempt to achieve diversity and multiculturalism without economic justice, without attending to economic justice at all. In other words, without attending to class and class conflict. So, as we say, you can't get there from here. As long as we're only going to do neoliberal ways, you can't beat neoliberalism at its own game. And to make bad matters worse, it has recreated new forms of racism and sexism, even while it denies that it is a racist, sexist project. It is indeed. Entrepreneur, some feminist writers have said, is a culturally coded term for men. I think that's true. I think it is a male-identified term. And what we now have in neoliberalization is the globalization of patriarchy. What we have under neoliberalization is the globalization of racism, even as it celebrates multiculturalism and diversity. I mean, cancer couldn't do a better job than this, right? Cancer lives off its hosts. So does neoliberalism. It's even turned progressives into people who are complicit with its cause, unfortunately. Another new book, not a new book, this actually came out before my book, and I just became aware of it recently, a book edited by Chakravarti and Ferreira da Silva. The book is entitled Race, Empire, and the Crisis of the Subprime. This is an edited volume, came out in 2013. And they have pointed out now neoliberalization and debt production is what they're focusing on. And many other, William Davies, who's an economist in Britain, many others have pointed out. In Italy, Lazzarato has pointed this out in his book by the unfortunate title, Indebted Man, that neoliberalism is finance capitalism. It lives off debt and debt production. So Chakravarti and Ferreira da Silva point out that the production of debt globally has followed the contours of the old colonial era. So it is disproportionately putting in debt people of color worldwide. What we have in neoliberalism is neo-coloniality, which is true both in the United States. Look at the problems that the race tensions we're having now have grown and magnified. Why? Because, and this again has been off the radar, class power has been used to push people of color more and more into the mire. Class power has been used to deprive women of a voice politically and culturally. So this old dichotomy of class versus, and we've seen this after the election of Trump, unfortunately, and this includes my friends. So I'm trying to bring my friends on board. You know, I've had friends put posts on Facebook or repost blogs that are out on the internet that have titles like "The White Working Class Doesn't Exist" or "To Talk About Class as a Cover for Racism." I get it. I get that we can't get past past racism when we look at the movement. I can't get past racism when I'm looking at Trump. I mean, my two adopted sons are African American. So for personal and professional reasons of care, the racism of the Trump movement is horrifying to me, as well as the sexism and misogyny. We don't need to look past the racism to get class power on the board. Racism exists as it does today, not only because of class and class power, but class power is one of the primary ways that we have oppressed people of color and people of certain gender and other minorities. We just wouldn't have this new sort of racism and sexism without it. A racism and sexism that denies that it's racist and sexist, of all things. We've even spun it around and say that people who talk about racism are the real racists because they're playing the race card. Now, this is a racism we haven't seen before. It's the racism of third-order suffering. It's the racism that's been deprived of a civil rights movement, right? At least so far. There's some signs now with Black Lives Matter. We may be getting back on board with a civil rights movement again. I hope that's the case. With the Women's March on Washington, we may be getting back to a suffrage movement, you know, and a new wave of feminism, another wave of feminism. I hope we are. But these movements simply will not be successful without including the economic injustice that is being done to women and people of color and white working people. As long as we continue to divide laborers by race and leave anyone out, including the white working class, we're not getting anywhere. So politically, this means we need to get people who voted for Trump on board, especially the working class who voted for Trump. Capital has always used ways of dividing the working class by race, by gender, by any form it could, in order to conquer. And it's doing it yet again. So we need to stop this. I read an article online just this week about the Black Panthers in the 1960s collaborating with a white supremacist group.
Wow.
I didn't know that had happened. Did you?
No.
Yes, it did. And I forget the name of the white supremacist group, but I mean in every way. They were using the Confederate flag to, you know, promote their cause. But it was a working class, a white working class, white supremacist group in Chicago. And the leaders of the Black Panthers decided they needed to sit down with these people. But they had some common cause based on class conflict. And lo and behold, if they did not form a detente with this group, and this group of white working class, mostly men, eventually laid down their Confederate flags and went into collaboration with the Black Panthers for the cause of workers' justice in Chicago. Now, it's when those kinds of transracial efforts at social justice have occurred in this country that they've been killed. It was not long after that that the three Black Panther leaders were assassinated, you know, killed in their sleep in Chicago. The same thing happened during the Reconstruction period following the Civil War. We had a transracial labor movement called the Knights of Labor. And freed slaves, who were now freedmen, along with landless poor whites, got together to form the Knights of Labor. And this was put down by the use of the American military. All right. In fact, I didn't know until reading an article just yesterday that in the United States we had nothing called the National Guard until Reconstruction. And the U.S. government thought it was unseemly to let the U.S. Army out killing and machine gunning down its own citizens. So it formed the National Guard to put down labor riots in this country. That's why we have the National Guard. Hmm. So we've had this movement, but you don't read about these in high school history textbooks.
Right.
Hell, we don't even have it in college textbooks. So there's almost no sign of American labor in U.S. history textbooks, even at the college level. Hmm. So these are the kinds of things we need to get on board if we're to have hope, if we're to have, you know, a meaningful care of souls in our time. As I say in the book, it can't be done. It's not a psychotherapy project. Mm-hmm. I mean, I try to help people. I'm still a practicing psychotherapist. But part of what I'm trying to do in my own practice is to make the unconscious conscious in a sense that Freud didn't totally do. Mm-hmm. What is most unconscious today is there's an analyst named Lynn Layton who says that neoliberalism delinks personal suffering from its social context. Mm-hmm. So that making the unconscious conscious today means helping people to see what's in the water around them that's making them sick. You know, helping them to see that the erosion of collectives that can provide them a meaningful home, helping them to see that economic inequality and so forth might have as much to do with their depression as their brain chemistry. Right. Probably more. Well, that does something for people, but it doesn't do enough. You know, we're going to have to get together as movements again for anything. That's where the care of souls is really going to matter today, is in movements.
Thank you, Bruce. I've been talking with Bruce Rogers Vaughn, Associate Professor of the Practice of Pastoral Theology and Counseling, about his recent book, Caring for Souls in a Neoliberal Age, part of the series New Approaches to Religion and Power, published by Palgrave Macmillan. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.